Hey, y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Got a good one lined up for you today. I'm going to complain about Israel and a lot of other things. I'm going to interview Nadia Ben-Yosef about the ethnic cleansing. Who made up that term cleansing for forced march, ethnic pogroms? But anyway, Nadia Ben-Yosef, she'll be on to talk about the Israelis cleansing the Bedouins from their ancestral villages in the Negev Desert. You know, because the Israelis feel like it, and they can do whatever they want to whoever they want because they can, and what are you going to do about it? That's what they thought. So, that's coming up. And, I got a couple invites. I'm waiting to hear back on a couple of possibilities. But also, when the commercials come, I'm going to make another couple of phone calls because I got another couple of ideas. It was a very busy morning, okay? I had other things to do than line up radio guests. I did succeed in lining up Peter Jenkins for tomorrow. And that's a real score because you may remember I've interviewed him one time before. Peter Jenkins, he's the former British ambassador, something or other. I forgot his title. But he was an ambassador. And I believe that he represented the British in the old E3 negotiations with Iran back 03 through 05. I might have that wrong. It was something like that. So anyway, he's writing for Jim Loeb's blog now. And he wrote a great one about Iran's sanctions. And especially coming from who it's coming from, it seemed very valuable to me. And he will be on the show tomorrow. And so will Jacob Hornberger from the Future Freedom Foundation be on the show tomorrow, too. So that will be a good one. And you better listen good because I'm going to be gone next week. I'm going to go visit the in-laws. Which should be fun. I'm going to miss doing the radio show for a whole week, but that's life. So listen up, enjoy it while you can, or maybe space out and don't pay too close of attention. That way, when you hear a bunch of reruns next week, you won't mind so much. Because you'll think, oh yeah, you know, I only half listened to this part before, and maybe now I'll pick up the other half. That's a good idea, isn't it? But anyway, here's some big news. I think the Pew, whatever the hell, Public Trust, whatever they call themselves, the survey group, they did their survey again. So consumed over at Pew they are with Americans' attitudes towards world empire. And if you are a regular reader of Justin Raimondo at antiwar.com, then you might have noticed his article today is all about the Pew and all about the people versus the establishment and our differing views about American power. But one point that I think that Justin missed was that this is the first time, I mean, the rest of his criticism still stands. But this is the first time that I'm aware of where it's the Pew Charitable Trust. That's what it's called. That do these surveys. This is the first time that they have differentiated, have allowed for there to be a difference between a non-interventionist and an isolationist. Oh, will we cower in the shadows of isolationism like some crazy old reactionary from a long time ago? Or will we embrace the brave new future of the world empire? Those are the only two choices we've ever had, according to them. But what's funny is, in print, in their publication this time, it's at pew.org or whatever, and also In their interview yesterday, which I happened to hear on National Public Radio, Know Your Enemy and all of that, they actually pointed out they couldn't help but to acknowledge that the American people, as anti-war as they've ever been, you know, like we just finished losing Vietnam or something, the American people are for world trade. It says here, the reticence to of foreign interventionism is not an expression of across-the-board isolationism. Even as doubts grow about the United States' geopolitical role, most Americans say the benefits from U.S. participation in the global economy outweigh the risks, and support for closer trade and business ties with other nations stands at its highest point in more than a decade. So here, it's amazing. It was funny to me yesterday to hear this on National Public Radio when they're talking about this. It had to have occurred to them, right? That, geez, I guess we really do owe Ron Paul an apology. He never was an isolationist. Two full-scale presidential campaigns in a row, we call them an isolationist. No matter how many times he insisted that he wasn't, no matter how many times he insisted that he wanted every kind of private, voluntary exchange between the American people and all other people of the world, and opposed every kind of U.S. government intervention in the affairs of others at the same time. Oh, they try to pretend like he never said the first part. Oh, Ron Paul, he just wants to cower in the shadows of isolationism. And yet, here the American people have adopted Ron Paul's view. We want no war, but we are absolutely in favor of world trade and an open engagement and relationship with the other people of the world. Again, support for closer trade and business ties with other nations stands at its highest point in more than a decade, at the same time that the question of whether the U.S. government should mind its own business is at an all-time high. It is the most lopsided balance, they call it, in favor of the U.S. minding its own business in the nearly 50-year history of the measure. Got it? Am I making myself clear? According to the Pew Charitable Trusts, the American people support international friendship more than ever before. International business ties. More than ever before. At the same time, their view that the U.S. government should butt out, that the U.S. military should stop killing people, is at an all-time high. Higher even than after Vietnam, according to them, in the nearly 50-year history of Pew doing this poll. I mean, that was the Cold War, after all. At least the Soviet Union actually existed, unlike the Islamo-fascist caliphate, which, you know, was hiding in the attic until it was killed, you know, a year and a half ago. But anyway, this is huge. And Justin goes on to completely trash the Pew Charitable Trust for their frame in all of this, which he's right that they, you know, they don't, when I say the U.S. government, they don't make that distinction. They conflate all these things together in their poll question. Are you for America being engaged or are you for America not being engaged? And crap like that. Well, maybe you're all for trade and maybe you're all for sending the Harlem Globetrotters to North Korea and maybe you're all for, you know, every kind of sports engagement and musicians and entertainment and authors and whoever. working together, engaging with each other, but you just don't want the U.S. government to do it at all. It's not in the poll question. It's in the Americans' response. Oh, yeah, international trade, we're all for it. International murder? No, it's time to call that off. And what's great and what's most important here, well, second place. The first of all, most important thing is that the American people are more anti-war than ever before. No thanks to the anti-war left, which almost entirely vanished once Obama took power. You know, the Answer Coalition dissolved. As though Barack Obama was anything other than Bill Clinton. And so without the leadership, and maybe because all of the hippies went home and shut up, the rest of the Americans feel, you know, better about being anti-war and don't feel like, oh man, that puts me in the same camp with Michael Moore and a bunch of know-nothing hippies singing Give Peace a Chance. And so, or maybe it's just they saw so many broken young men come home after fighting a war for Iran and Iraq that they just decided that, geez, man. And Al-Qaeda benefited too. Geez, man, what a... Maybe we put a stop to this. But in any case, the second most important part of this is the discrepancy between what the American people believe and what the Council on Foreign Relations believes. And now, of course, the Council on Foreign Relations, as Raimondo points out in his article today at antiwar.com/Justin, Long Live Isolationism, I believe is the title here. He's absolutely right that the Council on Foreign Relations was created by the Morgan banking interests after World War One, and their whole goal was basically to be the American branch of the British roundtable groups created by Cecil Rhodes and Lord Milner, basically with the mission of reuniting the American and the British empires, you know, at least in a de facto sense. And it's always, well, pretty much it's been always run by the Anglophiles all along. Although, yeah, things are more mixed now. There, you had the whole rise of the cowboys from the West on all that military-industrial complex money, and then, of course, the Israel firsters of the neoconservative movement and different factions. So it's, the Council on Foreign Relations no longer rules all. And then again, you know, Max Boot and Elliot Abrams and other neocons have gotten themselves very high-level perches at the Council on Foreign Relations, sort of bringing the CFR more into the neocon camp after they created their own kind of separate establishment. And, of course, Richard Haass, you know, he supposedly, he's the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He supposedly is a Colin Powell type, but he's just as bad as the neocons on everything. So I don't know how in the world he claims to be more realist or realistic than them on anything. He was the guy denouncing Obama for going to Congress before bombing Syria 2 months ago. But anyway, there are about 3,000 or 4,000, or typically there are about 3,000 or 4,000 members of the Council on Foreign Relations at any given time. And it basically, you know, it's not so much conspiracy. The creation of it certainly was, but the operation of it is much more, it's about forging consensus about what is to be done. And and if you look at the membership, they're, you know, pretty widespread throughout the establishment, in different areas of the establishment. It's more kind of the centrists among the imperialists there at the CFR, in other words. And like I'm always trying to tell you, the centrists are the real extremists. They're not really the moderates at all. You know, they pretend that they're not ideologues, that they're just, you know, real politique, balance of power type, realist sort of this or that. But what they are is they're bloody-minded imperialists, basically. And they're consensus, their moderate, middle-of-the-road, bipartisan consensus is for full-spectrum dominance. World empire. And of course, national suicide. Because the world, as small as it is compared to other big things in the universe, is way too big to be ruled by any one nation on it. Particularly one way the hell over here in the middle of North America. When the entire world island is on the other side of the planet. But anyway, that's their consensus. And not only is it the case that more than ever before do the American people disagree with the consensus for world empire, but it is also the case that the consensus for world empire among the elite has not budged. It's just that they are more detached from the opinions of those of us who they rule than ever before. And, you know, thankfully, for now, there seems to be a consensus that they want to deal with Iran instead of a war with Iran. But there's also consensus for a Pacific pivot and an Africa pivot and for staying in the Middle East, in the Persian Gulf, and continued ultimate, unlimited, unconditional support for Israel forever, and bribes to all their neighbors to pretend they don't hate them, and whatever else is necessary to take care of their interests over there. And in fact, you know, even the nuclear deal with Iran is about protecting Israel's interest more than it is about America's. In fact, if anything, it's probably about Obama trying to figure out a way to make Benjamin Netanyahu just shut up. You know, can you imagine being the president of America, being any president of America, and having to deal with Benjamin Netanyahu? God dang, man. As when they caught Obama and the French prime minister, the French president on the open microphone, and Obama was telling the Frenchman, I forgot who it was exactly, foreign minister, or somebody was saying, oh, you think you hate him? I got to deal with him every day. Well, geez. Maybe if we scaled down their progress toward that red line way, way down, maybe that'll buy me a week and a half of silence. That might be the foreign policy strategy of the U.S. And of course, it's backfiring. You can't reason with the Israelis. You can't reason with the Likud party. They're just getting madder than ever before. What do you mean you're trying to take this issue away from us? Hell no. Anyway. Oh, no. Well, I thought Michael Bolden was going to be on the show today, but it turns out I was reading that wrong. Now that I've taken a closer look. But looks like we might have somebody from the 10th Amendment Center on the show tomorrow. Hey, that's already three interviews for tomorrow, isn't it? Cool. Bolden, Hornberger, and Jenkins. What's this guy's name? Mike something? All right. So tomorrow, somebody from the 10th Amendment Center will be on. Did you guys see this thing in U.S. News? Some NSA opponents want to nullify surveillance with state law. Yeah, count me among them. And this is a very important article here. Boy, I don't know. It's just the existence of this article in U.S. News and World Report is just 9 months pregnant with possibilities, isn't it? Let's think of who might be looking at this and might want to get in on it. See if we can nullify and interpose and shut down the NSA with the help of the 10th Amendment Center. Hey, Al Scott here, inviting you to check out Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. It's a great little independent publication out of Phoenix, Arizona, featuring unique views on economics, politics, foreign policy, sports, and music, with great art scene coverage and fiction writing as well. That's Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. Hey, Al Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. Libertystickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is the show, my show, Scott Horton's show here on Liberty Express. Just trying to get a hold of another guest during the break there. Anyway, okay, good. So, well, we got tomorrow's show all lined up for you. That's good to know. But yeah, you know, so I don't know. I'm sorry I was going on so long instead of keeping it all short and sweet. I think it's major progress that the Pew Charitable Trusts, the centrist establishment view of the world, that their way of looking at things now, probably mostly because of Ron Paul and his appeal over the last 6-7 years, they have been forced to acknowledge the fact, basically, that there's no such thing as isolationism. As Justin Raimondo says, there's no such creature anywhere in America as an isolationist. I mean, obviously, libertarians are not isolationists because libertarians object to any government intervention preventing the voluntary and peaceful exchange of any kind between consenting adults. As simple as that. A Chinaman and a Canadian got the natural born human right to deal with each other, and it's none of your damn business. Simple as that. Or an American too. Simple as that. But even the conservative, paleo, anti-free trade, pro-tariff, pro-protectionism, paleocons, and the left liberal union ACLU types, they're for global trade. They just want some tariffs too. They want to protect their guys and this and that, whatever intervention. But there is not a political force anywhere in America. There never has been. Not in a century anyway, or who knows how long it's been since anyone in America said that our government and our people should have no relationship with anyone else in the world at all. The only nation in the world that exists like that right now is North Korea. And even they have ties with China. And, you know, they talk with other countries like Russia, and when America will let them, South Korea, and et cetera like that. They had the Harlem Globetrotters over, which was the biggest blown opportunity of the Barack Obama administration since he blew the Brazil-Turkey-Iran deal back in the spring of 2010. He blows a lot of great opportunities, Barack Obama. But even in North Korea, they're not isolationist. To call any American anti-war force, even the hardest leftists or the hardest rightists on trade issues and on foreign empire building issues, it would be inaccurate to call any of them isolationists. And at this point, they're not even, at this point, the Pew Charitable Trust and their CFR types, they have to acknowledge that, in essence, there's no such thing. That the American people are for every type of international engagement except sending the CIA and the military to disrupt other people's societies. Where do we get off anyway, huh? Somebody's got to lead the world, right? Who comes up with this stuff anyway? Well, you know who does. Liberals and conservatives. You know, they're half good on stuff and they're half bad on stuff, the liberals and the conservatives. And there's a strong strain in conservative thought that says, kill everything because I'm terrified. And there's a strong strain among liberals that says, kill everything because the world is my sociology project. And we're working hard on our utopia called fair living wage land or whatever crap. save Saddam Hussein, save the people of Iraq from Saddam Hussein out of love project. Come on, Democrats, get on board. We're going to make the world a better place. And they love power. See, they don't believe in really freedom or free exchange as being capable of solving any problem in the world. They reject that outright. That's the evil, greedy profit motive of capitalism, which must be overcome. And the only way to overcome it is through state power. And now most liberals, honestly, don't believe in totalitarianism as far as choosing who gets to participate in power, right? There, we're social democrats, they say. Hold elections by all means. But then, of course, there ought to be no limit on the authority of the state to order society however they want. You know, people often say about what a shame it is, liberals often say, what a shame it is that Vietnam really destroyed what Lyndon Johnson really wanted to do, which was create the Great Society. But really, what was the Vietnam War other than the very same Great Society Lyndon Johnson liberals saying that only we have the tools to give the South Vietnamese the ability to live up to the principles of the Declaration of Independence, right? How else in the world could the South Vietnamese ever get what they need? Freedom. Unless we give it to them. You know, by killing all who resist our authority. And, you know, it's true that there are, you know, human rightsy progressives and liberals and anti-war leftists who turned against that. But it's, you know, in practice. But it was really their ideology that was being played out. And if you looked at the most powerful people in the government who were playing it out, they were true believers. And also, I don't think it can be overstated, typically speaking, what cowards conservatives are. I mean, that is what a conservative is, right? They want maybe, to some of them, some kind of golden ideal past that they believe has gone. But at the very least, they'll settle for keeping everything exactly the way it is now. Because whatever else might happen is terrifying. What if the Islamo-fascist caliphate gets me? Boo-hoo, and then they all pee in their pants. And go read Daniel Pipes and Bill Kristol for their horror stories about what might happen if you teach little black children to read or stop bombing Arabs for more than 15 minutes. Oh, danger. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why Peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and our guest on the show today is Nadia Ben-Yosef. She's a human rights lawyer and international advocate working to promote the rights of Palestinian citizens of Israel, as well as Palestinians living under the occupation. She is the international advocacy coordinator for Adala, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Nadia?
Thanks so much, Scott, for having me. Doing well.
Very good to hear that, and thank you very much for joining us. So tell me, when is the brutal Bedouin occupation of Israel ever going to end there?
Oh, my goodness.
I'm sorry, I'm just playing. poor little Israel, besieged on all sides. In this case, some Bedouin villagers just won't leave them alone, I guess, huh?
Is that the case?
Yeah, no, I'm just being sarcastic, trying to set you up to explain the truth of things so people don't get it. What's a Bedouin? Where are they living? What's the proper plan here?
Okay, so the Bedouin community have been living in the Negev, or the Nakab in Arabic, which is in southern Israel, the Negev Desert, about 60% of the land of Israel. They've been living there since the 7th century. And the Bedouin derives from the Arabic word Badia, which is desert. So Bedouin means people who live in the desert. So they're really history's first desert farmers. So they're a rural community that, again, have been living in this area since the 7th century. And since 1948, so since the establishment of the State of Israel, the Bedouin have been facing a policy from Israel of forced displacement and confiscation of their land, and forcibly concentrating them into smaller areas, and especially into urban settings. So this, again, is a traditionally rural community, pastoral, so they're shepherds and farmers. And the government policy of Israel since the establishment of the state, since 1948, has been to confiscate their land and to displace this community into urban settings. So the proper plan is really just the latest iteration of government policy towards the Bedouin. And again, the Bedouin are citizens of Israel, which I think is a really important point to consider. So since the 1952 citizenship law, the Bedouin have been citizens, full citizens of Israel. And so the proper plan is a forcible displacement of really the most vulnerable community in Israel.
Well, and that is an extremely important point, that we're not talking about occupied Palestinians in the West Bank or the Gaza Strip or in East Jerusalem here, that these are citizens of Israel. And it really brings up the question of the form of the Jim Crow laws there. We hear from time to time, it's actually not often discussed, of course, but we hear from time to time that non-Jewish citizens of Israel are treated as second-class citizens, although usually it sounds like it's just sort of de facto, that the law would say that you couldn't do this to a village full of Bedouins any more than you could do this to a village full of Jews in Israel. But is that actually the case? Is it legal that, oh, well, you know, if you go back to the 7th century, then you're an illegal immigrant here and you got to go, or what?
That's a great question, Scott, and I think you're hitting exactly the issue. So the proper plan is being implemented by what's known as the Proverbagan Bill. And this is what the community is really fighting against right now at the present moment, and that your listeners should kind of be aware of, is the Proverbagan Bill is exactly that. It's the legitimization and the legalization of this policy of forced displacement. And it joins a wave of discriminatory legislation that we've seen that directly targets Palestinian citizens of Israel, either explicitly by name, like the Proverbagan Bill, which applies only to Bedouin citizens of Israel, or implicitly. So, yeah, I mean, what's amazing about this, and you're also bringing up the issues of displacement in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Gaza as well, and I think that's relevant. I think thinking about this as an overall strategy of Israel to displace Palestinians wherever they are is really important. But the Proverbagan Bill, yes, explicitly targets the rights of Bedouin citizens of Israel, and in fact suspends any constitutional protections that they may have, so the right to property or the right to human dignity according to Israel's basic laws, or human rights protections, of course, the right to adequate housing and the right to self-determination, this right to non-discrimination. So it suspends those rights in favor of an administrative regime, which again is really interesting. So it allows for a very speedy execution of the demolition and eviction orders to forcibly displace this community in a very short amount of time.
And now, how many people are we talking about again?
Yeah, so we're talking directly targeted by the Proverbagan Bill are the 70,000 Bedouin, again, citizens of Israel that live in what are called unrecognized villages. And these are 35 villages that either predate the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948 or were created by military order in the 1950s. And going back to your ideas, is this legal? In fact, according to Israeli, basically the Israeli government has cloaked this with a very thin veneer of legality. So in fact, the displacements are quote-unquote legal in that after the establishment of the State of Israel, Israel confiscated Palestinian-owned lands through various legal measures. So you first had the absentee property law in 1950, and then in 1953, the land acquisition law, which legalized the confiscation of the majority of Palestinian-owned land in Israel. And overnight, the land of the Negev, where the Bedouin live, became state land, and the Bedouin therefore became trespassers on state land. So their homes, their villages became illegal, and so their buildings illegal, they became trespassers in the eyes of the state. So the demolition and displacement of their homes, according to Israel, is just an upholding of the law, which is ironic. I mean, this is coming from a human rights lawyer who's looking at this and saying, okay, so what are the protections if, in fact, the displacement and the violations of human rights of these people is considered legal, quote unquote?
Yeah, it sounds like it's almost a miracle that they're still there in 2013.
Well, I think that's it. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And there's been concerted efforts by Israel to displace this community forcibly or by, and this is what's happening in the unrecognized villages, the withholding of basic services. So they deny, again, citizens of Israel, these Bedouin citizens of Israel are denied access to water, electricity, sewage, roads, schools, health clinics, in an effort to pressure the community to abandon their ancestral land and move into these government-planned townships, of which there are seven. And I think that resonates really a lot with American audiences, the idea of taking a traditional indigenous rural community away from their ancestral land and forcing them to be urbanized with dramatic and really detrimental impact on the community.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, as most recently highlighted by Nick Turse in his book, Kill Anything That Moves, this was the policy in Vietnam. That whole war was waged against not so much the North Vietnamese army as it was against the population of South Vietnam to round them up, basically, like communists, round them up and put them on giant collectively owned properties where, of course, they all had nothing. Same
yeah,
kind
I mean,
of thing.
This is, yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting. It's taking, although this is more, the indigenous community has a traditional land ownership scheme that's much more community-based than it is individual-based.
Right, which is still a lot different than being rounded up and put in a prison together and being told this is your new collective property, you know?
Right, although, yeah.
Which is, it sounds like this is a lot more like, you know, being put in a prison, sort of like the Ethiopian crisis of the 1980s. That was all basically a government manufactured crisis. They took the last arable farmland away from the people farming it. And
right. It also reminds me. This is as an American born and raised in eastern Montana. Really reminds me of the policy of forced displacement of the American Indian population in the United States. And you're finding a lot of really interesting parallels with regard to President Andrew Jackson's support of the Indian Removal Act in the 1860s. And you're seeing that same sort of discourse coming from Israel that this is a benefit to the community, that this is being done out of benevolent generosity from the state, trying to bring the Bedouin community into the 21st century. So a lot of paternalistic and patronizing language that's being used when the Bedouin are being really disenfranchised from determining their own future.
Right. And, of course, all of this in the context of there was no Nakba. This is a land without people for a people without land. And, by the way, it continues to this day.
Right. I mean, that's kind of the... You're hearing from the Bedouin community and representatives who are calling the proper plan the second Nakba, though you've also heard a lot of, you know, academics and civil society who are talking, as you said, about an ongoing Nakba, so a policy of forced displacement that began even before 1948 and is continuing today.
Mm-hmm. And now, it's something that occurs to me that, you know, public relations is such a big part of Israeli policy in the United States, and, you know, they have their own special word for it, of course, Hasbara, and all of that, and it reminds me of, when I read about this, it reminds me of I'm trying to remember who did the interview. This may have been from the Penn and Teller show on Showtime or something, where they talked to Frank Luntz. And one of his things, it was something else. Anyway, it was one of his things. It was advice to the pro-Israel lobby in America of how to spin Israeli policies, especially in the occupied territories and in East Jerusalem. But it could apply here as well, where apparently it had been part of their campaign to tell the Americans that, hey, listen, these Palestinians are in violation of the zoning codes. And so they're against the law, and that's why we have to do this. And Frank Luntz had tested that in front of his focus groups. And Americans hate zoning laws. And that made Americans turn against Israel more than anything else they'd ever heard. What do you mean you're zoning these people out of their houses? And so he said, oh, no, don't ever say zoning again. That's the wrong word to use. But it just goes to show the reality of the situation here, where if the American people ever had the truth spoken to them, frankly, about the occupation and about ethnic cleansing situations like what's happening in the Negev Desert right now to these Bedouins, the support would end. That's why it's all a bunch of spin at best and blatant dishonesty at worst.
Yeah, I think this is why your show and others like it are very important. The idea that we should do our best to inform the American public. And I think you're right to have a lot of optimism with regard to if the American public knew what was happening, and especially with the blatant discrimination that's happening, I think they would be very troubled. And I think there just needs to be, as you said, a more honest conversation about what's happening in Israel, both to, again, citizens of Israel, as well as what's happening, of course, in the occupied Palestinian territory. Mm.
And, you know, honestly, and for the audience, I'm probably repeating myself, those have been listening a while anyway, I'm basically kind of pleading guilty myself, and I at the same time, I'm accusing my fellow Americans of knowing nothing about this. I'm referring back to a younger me who defaulted to things like, well, you know, they're all fighting over God gave us this land and God gave that this land and whatever, and so you can never solve that kind of problem, and so I don't really need to know that much more about it. Where, and point being, I didn't even understand that there was a permanent occupation. It wasn't just, and never mind, of course, the second-class citizenship of the Arab Israelis, but the Israeli citizens, but the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, I just didn't know anything about it. I mean, basically, it was, I guess, the territory next door, and these terrorists just keep attacking Israel, whatever. And it's not that I had really strong feelings about it either way. Again, I was pretty dismissive of the whole thing, that nobody's right. They're all claiming magical property rights going back thousands of years. How could any rational beings ever solve that? But it turns out that just TV was lying to me by omission in such an important way that I actually did not understand that there was an occupation of Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And I think that when and I'm talking about, you know, 14 or 15-year-old me, or maybe a little older than that. Mm-hmm. But I think that basically is the point of view of most Americans, that they don't even understand that what the occupation is, to know that, hey, that isn't right.
Absolutely. I think that's exactly it. And in fact, thinking about the occupation, thinking about the situation in Israel and the OPT, felt, as you said, very gray, that this seemed like a intractable conflict, quote-unquote, what's happening here and who's going to be able to solve it. And I think studying it, even just a bit, the situation becomes much more black and white, which is really interesting because it does seem like something impossible to understand, and yet it becomes very clear, the asymmetry of power that exists and where the responsibility lies and who the duty bearer is. And just as it is for citizens of Israel as those living under occupation, Israel, the government of Israel, is the duty bearer that needs to protect the rights of Palestinians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, you'd think people would get hip to the idea just from all the talk about there maybe one day will be a Palestinian state. Well, that kind of implies that there isn't one now. They do not have independence. They're occupied by a foreign power now longer than the Soviets occupied Eastern Europe.
You're right. It's a prolonged occupation. Exactly.
And by the way, Are the peace talks even going at all anymore? I guess the Palestinian negotiators all quit except Abbas. Is he even still talking to Netanyahu at this point, or what's going on with that? Anything?
Well, to be honest, I'm not deeply following the negotiations, and I think that might be the case for many people. But many are very disillusioned by the quote unquote process and what the process has indeed meant for the last 20 years, starting from the Oslo Accord. So the idea of negotiations is met with a lot of skepticism, because inside the issue is that the underlying root cause of the problem, both the proper plan, the prolonged occupation, is not really being addressed and needs to be addressed in order for kind of the daily emergencies to stop, and then also for a just solution.
Well, and I guess, you know, the process, really, even Chomsky has pointed out numerous times that this whole thing is just about establishing facts on the ground, meaning more settlements, a bigger and bigger security zone in Area C and whatever, until there's just no use in even talking about a Palestinian state anymore, that the whole West Bank at that point would just be, you know, outright annexed. They would go from de facto to de jure with just a stroke of a pen, rather than any further change of facts, right? They'll put off calling it that until the very last day. But then at that point, if they outright annex the West Bank, then they can no longer be Jewish and democratic, right? Because right now it's, what, an 80-20 split in favor of Jews in the electorate inside Israel, but it would be much closer to 50-50 anyway if they just outright annex the West Bank, right?
Right. I mean, I think this gets also to the main issue about how demographics plays a role in democracy and whether it should. The idea that a democracy can only be sustained so long as a demography is sustained is incredibly problematic and really undermines the principles of democracy generally. To view the Palestinian community inside Israel as a demographic threat to the democracy of the state, or the perceived democracy of the state, kind of goes to show how fragile that idea is. And this tension between a Jewish and democratic state really needs to be addressed in both scenarios. I mean, the idea of second-class citizenship would be entrenched if that indeed was the case. And so the human rights community really challenges this definition of the state, which Israel is putting forward more and more intensely. In fact, it has a basic law. So this is, again, a law of higher status. Israel doesn't have a constitution, but if it did, these basic laws would take place. And a basic law is being proposed by the coalition government. I mean, and this is the governing power now in Israel, that says if there is a contradiction between the Jewish nature of the state and the democratic nature of the state, the Jewish values and the Jewish nature would take precedence, which I think is pretty extraordinary. So and there have been polls inside Israel, Jewish Israeli adults being asked, would you rather live in a Jewish state or in a democratic state? And the overwhelming 67% said a Jewish state. And so we're really challenging, and the proper plan challenges that. It says if this was an equal and democratic state, the Bedouin community would have equal agency to their Jewish neighbors, equal rights, and there would be no such thing as a law that suspends their constitutional protection. So you have a case now in the Negev with the Proverbagan bill that says if you had a Jewish trespasser and a Bedouin trespasser in the Negev, so everyone's wrong, the Jewish trespasser would have access to the courts, would be able to defend themselves, would have all of their constitutional protections and constitutional rights intact, whereas the Bedouin citizen of Israel has those rights suspended, cannot go to court, cannot defend himself, and if they do not comply with demolition and eviction orders, could face up to 2 years in prison. And they need to move to an urban town, whereas their Jewish neighbors have a choice to live in, you know, kibbutzim or moshavim or even single-family farms. So the discrimination is inherent and entrenched and made legitimate by this new, by the Proffer-Bagin bill that's being passed now in the Knesset.
That's amazing. It sounds almost like Dred Scott or something that, well,
it's
geez,
extraordinary.
If he's got these rights, and that implies those rights too, and we can't have that.
Right, because equality is a threat to the system, and I think that needs to be made very clear in the United States, and we need to wrestle with that as, of course, the major supporter of the state of Israel. So what does that mean? What does it mean that equality is a threat to the state, and why aren't we demanding that, both as the United States and as the larger international community, that says the only thing that should be privileged in a democratic state is equality? We need to privilege equality. We cannot privilege ethnicity or religion as Israel is trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, you did say they're passing. They've passed stage one of this, and they're still working on the second part, which is the second and final part, right?
Exactly. So in June of this year, it passed its first reading, which is the initial vote, and then in the coming weeks, we'll see both the second and third reading happening on the same day. So this would be the second reading is basically the final passage. The third is a technicality that confirms the law.
And then, so what are the odds going into this thing? Is there much pressure against it at all?
Well, from the community itself, yes, tremendous pressure. And I think it's one of the most exciting things that's happened in the region in a long time. Is last Saturday was the third, what's called the Day of Rage.
Mm-hmm.
This is a coordinated protest all over the region. So inside Israel and also in the occupied Palestinian territory, you had coordinated protests by Palestinian youth on both sides of the Green Line that were calling for an end of the Proffer Plan. And this is truly amazing, because you're having Palestinian youth who are not directly affected by the Proffer Plan seeing that it's relevant to their own lives, that the confiscation, and again, it would be the largest confiscation of Palestinian-owned land since the 1950s, matters to them. It matters to all of them. So you're seeing unprecedented coordination across the Green Line, Palestinian youth saying, this is about us, this is about the Nakba, and we challenge it on the basis of our human rights and on the basis of equality. And I think the government is very concerned about this development, but it's really exciting. And as to whether or not the Proffer Plan will pass, I mean, this is a priority of the coalition government. So informing the coalition this spring, the government agrees to kind of its outline for what it hopes to accomplish in its government, and the Proffer Plan was one of these top five priorities. So it has the broad support of the coalition. Again, the community is the community is entirely against it. The government will say this is a very small but loud minority, and that's not true. It's the Bedouin community as a whole is rejecting this plan and asking the government to instead adopt an alternative plan, which was an initiative of the community and civil society that calls for the recognition of the 35 unrecognized villages on the basis of equality.
Mm-hmm. And now, so what about the Jewish left and I don't know, are there any parties of any significance to the left of labor, or is labor any good on this, or is there any kind of outcry from within Jewish Israel about this?
So you're seeing a bit more, again, with international scrutiny.
Mm-hmm.
There's been some, which is pretty extraordinary. The European Parliament last summer called for a withdrawal of the plan.
That was going to be my next question. Is the EU at least good on this?
Yeah, and the UN, so the European Parliament called for withdrawal of the plan. The UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination called the plan discriminatory and asked for its withdrawal. It's been raised at every international forum that Israel has been a part of in the last few years. And so the international community is watching. The U.S. obviously hasn't spoken out against the Proffer Plan, and doing so would be a tremendous achievement, and would probably have, you know, the most impact if possible. That would be something that we should all strive for, is to get the American decision makers to speak out against this plan on behalf of the Palestinian Bedouin community. But the first vote was actually fairly close. It passed 43-40. But part of the opposition to the plan comes from the far right that called the plan too generous to the Bedouin community. And so that's also playing an impact, is that the right is opposing the plan because they don't want the... they believe that, again, the proper plan is too generous.
Oh, geez. Well, let's hope we can count on their malevolent intentions to scotch this thing. It's really something else. It just seems so out of step with everything else on Earth right now, at least what's considered acceptable on Earth right now in any other place. I mean, not that there's not horrible sin going on all the time, but this is just, it just sounds like a throwback to the first half of the 20th century or something.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, it's a great point. The issue, too, is the idea of legality, that, you know, there are horrific violations of human rights happening around the world, but there's not a government that's saying, yes, but this is legal, or yes, this is within our right to do this.
Right.
I mean, they frankly don't really care about rights or about legality. What you're seeing in Israel is this, again, the veneer of legality that they say, yes, we're doing it. Yes, we're displacing this community, and yes, it's legal. Yes, it's within our rights to violate or to even suspend their human rights or their constitutional rights.
Yeah, and of course, maybe America can't even do anything about it at this point. Remember, Biden's walking off the plane, and they're announcing new settlements just to scotch his visit, which was to tell them to do a settlement freeze to try to work on this thing. I mean, they don't care. Not about America or any of the rest of the UN or anything else, so... Yeah, it's going to have to be internal opinion inside Israel and Jerusalem and Tel Aviv that make the difference. So maybe we can.
I don't know about that. Ultimately, yes, at some point in history, there will have to be an internal change. But I don't. If we wait for that, we'll never see the end. I think.
Well, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm for America threatening at least to withhold every bit of aid and support and everything until they get their act together. I'm just not.
There needs to be external pressure, absolutely. I think the only time that we've seen discriminatory laws get off the table is when there has been public condemnation from the international community. And I think there needs to be much more of that the world needs to remain vigilant and also recognize its responsibility within it. I think you're right to say. I mean, we have an unprecedented responsibility in this area, even as Americans, because of the amount of investment that we're placing in this government.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you so much for your time on the show today, Nadia. Appreciate
Thanks,
it. All right, everybody. That is Nadia Ben-Yosef, and she is from Adala, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel, and she's got a blog here at the Huffington Post. The latest one is Put a Stop to the Displacement of Bedouin Communities in Israel. Very important work. Please go check it out. We'll be right back. We're late. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing, it's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the thing here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. So, wow, she is good, man. I want to go back and read all the stuff that she wrote now. Nadia Ben Yosef is her name there. And, you know, I apologize to you guys. I apologize to Max Blumenthal. I apologize to everybody that I have not finished Max's book yet. He covers so much of this ground in his book, Goliath. And it's great. I'm 200 pages into it. I just got 300 more to go. And teeny tiny little letters too, man. I don't know. But it's great. I just, man, I'm a busy guy. I got all these things I gotta do all the time. So I'm trying. I gotta get the hell off of Facebook, man, and get some book reading done. Facebook.com/Scott Horton Show, by the way, if you want to be my friend. But anyway, it's really good. And something that I... Well, you know what? I don't cover Palestine issues nearly enough on the show as it is. But then, as a subset of that, I really don't cover Israeli Arabs, so-called Israeli Arabs. Not in the occupied territories, but how they live inside Israel proper, which is actually a very interesting subject to me. It's just, I don't know where to read a whole lot about it all the time or who I'll talk about it. I admit, after years and years and years of this, I ought to have a really good stable of Palestinian interviewees. It's just so much easier for me to find liberal American Jews who are good on Israel, like Philip Weiss or Max Blumenthal, and they speak in a language that Americans understand. I'm trying to get through to people here, and I'm just lazy. I already know Phil and Max, you know what I mean? But I do need to work on that. I know a Palestinian libertarian, Dean Ahmed, who I had to interview him more often. He's really good on all this stuff as well. It's Dean Ahmad, and I always mispronounce it. I'm sorry. But anyway, yeah, well, you're paying for it. It's like the Jim Crow South. That's what it is, only in the Eastern Mediterranean and on your dime. God, I'm so poor. I need the government to take over the healthcare industry to try to pay my way, because they raised the prices so high with all their intervention in the market that now I need their help, and I'm so broke because the government gave all of my money to the Israelis so they could use it to bring a bulldozer down on some family's house so they could steal the land and build a condo and pretend it's their God-given right. What a joke. And by the way, man, did you guys see this thing in the Washington Post last night? I don't know if it's today's or yesterday's issue, man. I just went to their page yesterday and thought, oh my goodness gracious. You people need to chill out. This is, again, it's the Washington Post. Don't anybody get your feelings all riled up or anything. This is as mainstream as you can possibly be here. Jewish activists set sights on Jerusalem's Temple Mount, raising alarm in the Muslim world. And what it's about is these hardcore right-wing fundamentalists in Israel, they want to destroy the Golden Domed Mosque and what they call the Temple Mount. And they want to rebuild the Temple of Solomon and start sacrificing animals again. Seriously, it says this in the Washington Post, okay? In case you think this is some kookery. A frequent visitor to the site is Rabbi Chaim Richman, a director of the Temple Institute, whose mission is to prepare for the building of the third temple, where the Dome of the Rock now stands. He says he envisions a new temple rising toward the clouds with underground parking, internet connectivity, radiant heating for the sanctified floors, the priests, in accordance with Jewish law, will be barefoot, and a return of burnt offerings and animal sacrifice. And the thing of it is, as they point out again in this Washington Post piece, this site, what had been Solomon's Temple, is the place where Muhammad supposedly ascended up to heaven. And so after Mecca and Medina, but before every single holy site in Iraq, or anywhere else, third in line for most important holy sites in Islam, is the Golden Dome Mosque in Jerusalem. And, you know, I don't know, man. Anybody want to place bets on what would happen if the IDF went in there, if Netanyahu decided to change the policy and they sent the military in there to keep all the Arabs away and they demolished the mosque and rebuilt the third temple and started sacrificing animals? Holy moly. It's really too bad. I don't know. The crazy ways that people believe crazy things that lead them to do such horrible things. And that goes for all sides in this thing, really. You know, I saw that guy, George Galloway, who's actually horrible. He stole $1 million. Stole. Personally, $1 million that was meant for Iraqi orphans. That's not a lie. That's a fact. My friend was the one who proved it. And anyway, so he's the scum of the earth, George Galloway. But he said this brilliant thing the other day. Maybe it was just a tweet or something. I don't know. I noticed it. Some headline somewhere. Galloway says, "Hey, monotheists, what in the hell are you guys fighting about? Don't you just want to grab every Muslim, Christian, and Jew in the world and knock all their heads together and tell them, hey, you all worship the same God. He wants you to all get along. Yes, there are discrepancies in your more specific doctrines than that. And no, I'm not trying to encourage that you turn on the Hindus or anything either. I'm just saying. And I know, brother versus brother is always more vicious than strangers fighting. People who consider each other religious heretics, who, you know, who pervert the true truth, as opposed to somebody who's just completely outside it, right? Like a Buddhist. Do Muslims get mad at Buddhists? Do Sunni talk theories? Do they even care about Buddhists at all? Or they're mostly just concerned about killing Shiites, right? But man, get it together. If your God exists, he's the same one for all of y'all's traditions and all the different subsets of them too. Orthodox, Catholic, and every sect of Protestant. Same Jesus, same God. And same Moses and Abraham and God as the Jews and the Muslims too. The Muslims, of course, believe in Jesus not as the Savior, but as another prophet. As another Moses-type figure. Why should that be so hard? But no, you know what? We're going to tear down your mosque and build our temple. Oh, no. You know? And one of the things about this is, I believe that the consensus for now, and I don't know too much about this, but from what I've read, the consensus has been, I thought, that you can't do that yet or you'll make God really mad. Because you're supposed to wait until some magic thing happens that temple's rebuilt. This is not supposed to be the decisions of men and politicians to do. This is supposed to be a supernatural event for the third temple to ever come back into being. And the only exception to that is the myth of the red heifer. Did you guys see that South Park a few weeks ago? That was the best South Park in years. That was so funny. About them trying to engineer red heifer. And the thing of it is, you can read an old Justin Raimondo article about this as well. Beware the red heifer. And what it's about is literally some born-again Christians from here in Texas attempting to bankroll the genetic engineering of a pure red cow. Again, take the magic out of it. Do it with science. And then if you have a full-grown, pure red heifer, then that is the substitute for, that's like the secondary route to rebuilding the third temple or whatever once that happens. And then on South Park, they just kind of drop it on the roof of the temple and kill it. It's so funny, dude. Anyway, but what happened with this cow, and this happened in this century, in 2002 or something, 2003. But what happened was the rabbis said you have to wait until it's full grown. And then when it was full grown, there was a tuft of white hair on its tail. Whew. Because if it hadn't, apparently, if it hadn't had that tuft of white hair, if it had been pure red, genetically engineered by a bunch of born-again Christian Texans, if it had been pure red, then that would have been the signal to go ahead. And I don't know exactly on which rabbi's authority and how much authority he would have to say so, but on apparently a pretty official level, that would be the signal that it's okay to go ahead. And of course, the joke being, at least from my point of view, and I don't know who could disagree with this, that what would happen, of course, would be a lot of innocent people would die, and there'd be horrible difficulty, ripple effects throughout the world, perhaps a world war on some level, although I don't know why the Russians and the Chinese would do anything but stay out. I don't think it would be that kind of world war. What do they care? But certainly the Americans would be involved in the damn thing. Could be a huge war could break out. And then guess what? No savior, no magic, no apocalypse. I mean, maybe we all die in an apocalypse, but a scientific one. No rapture. No Walmart Bible where the devil takes over the United Nations. Just a bunch of dead people in another stupid war for stupid beliefs held by stupid people. And I don't mean to, I'm not trying to condemn all of all religion. I'm just talking about all this let's make prophecy come true and get a lot of people killed stuff. The fact that it's 2013 and that 2000 is 13 years gone and none of your magic crap happened yet means now's not the time. Try again in the year 3000. Until then, leave everybody the hell alone. Can't you just be people? You know, who the hell needs any kind of state solution in Israel-Palestine? Can't everybody just have their natural inherent dignity and try to sort out past wrongs as peacefully and individually as possible and move forward? You know, this whole debate about whether Israel should be Jewish and or democratic, whether it can be, and the polls say they'd rather be Jewish than democratic. Does that make any sense? No wonder they're so scared of the Bedouins, the Palestinians of the West Bank, that, geez, if they had authority over the state and used it against us the way we use it against them, hell no. Why, something bad would happen. But if the state was anything on a pretension of a legitimate state, which, hardy har har, but if their only authority was protecting everybody's rights equally, that would be corrupt because they would have to force you to participate as a taxpayer and as a subject to their rules and regulations. It would still be a non-libertarian thing, but still, give them the most minarchist, night watchman type of a thing as possible, and it doesn't matter who's Jewish, who's Christian, who's Muslim, who's from Eastern Europe, who's a Sephardic, whoever, who's a Bedouin or an Arab. Because, hey, they're just a bunch of people breathing the same air and sharing the same water fountain. And who cares what shape the temple is, you know? And, you know, I think you can tell, too, if you read this Washington Post article, they sort of kind of make it sound like, man, these East Jerusalem Muslims sure are racist bigots that they won't just let the Jews come and pray there. But that's not what they're afraid of, Jews coming and praying there. What they're afraid of is the Jews coming and taking it from them and destroying it. Starting a world war. they're not afraid of just letting them in. They know that it's the camel in the tent and all that, you know? So it's kind of dishonest in the Washington Post, but I think you could see right through it if you tried to read it and just say, well, what do the Muslims have to be worried about? Other than you know how those mean old Muslims are. In fact, I was mentioning Frank Luntz there and how he encouraged the Israel lobby to never use zoning as your excuse to steal from Palestinians because people hate that. Another one of his pieces of advice, Frank Luntz, the famous Republican pollster, another piece of advice was to portray the Palestinians as the whites in the Jim Crow South who refuse to let the poor occupied Israeli Jews live wherever they want. What kind of racists are they? They won't just let the Jews live wherever they want in the West Bank. And just completely ignoring that we're talking about occupied territory here. We're talking about the right of, let's switch shoes and other feet, the right of the state, the government of Mexico to draw a line around Laredo and claim it's their city now. And the Americans who live there now have to accommodate any Mexican who wants to move in. Oh, that's not quite the same thing, is it? It's the Palestinians who are, if you want to do the comparison, they're the blacks of the Jim Crow South that is instituted by the white supremacist, white European Israeli Jews who occupy their territory. That's just the truth of the situation. And in fact, it's funny because white racists will get so mad if you point out that the Israeli Jews are white people. They're the same ones who'll point out that they're actually hardly related to the Jews of antiquity at all. They're Eastern European converts to Judaism from a millennia ago, not two. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, y'all. Man, I gotta remember to normalize the volumes on these songs. It's driving me crazy. All right. Hey, Fitzy G in the chat room. He's smart. He makes a great point here that Frank Luntz isn't exactly a pollster like the Gallup poll or something like that. He's a propagandist. He runs these focus groups to sell war lies, mostly horrible, evil, massive global scale crimes to people like the latest product. In fact, hey Fitzy, help me out. Was Frank Luntz involved with the decision that Andrew Carr then later enunciated about the selling of the war to the American people that we're going to wait till after Labor Day? You don't never want to introduce a new product before Labor Day. And then, of course, talking about, that was in the fall of 02, talking about, or late summer of 02, talking about selling us the Iraq War. I think he got that from Frank Luntz. And that is absolutely right. His job is selling lies. So how do we, and this is what's funny. This gives away the whole game when it comes to Israel-Palestine, by the way, too, doesn't it? When all of his best advice for how the pro-Israel factions in America ought to argue his case, or argue their case, is lie. Lie your ass off. Just tell them that up is down and black is white and the truth is false. As simple as that. In fact, the best thing that you could do to pitch Israel's case is immediately break into an emotional breakdown, emotional cry of poor little Israel besieged on all sides by terrible enemies that just want to wash them away. And then that just completely destroys the subject of who's armed and who's helpless, who's occupying and who's occupied. Who gets unlimited zillions of dollars worth of Lockheed products for killing people with, and who's on the receiving end? It's changed the whole thing into poor little helpless Israel, surrounded on all sides by their terrible Muslim enemies, who of course are all united in every way. And it's just a lie. They're the oppressor. It's as simple as that. That's why everyone in the world except Americans agree with that. It's not because everyone else in the world are all a bunch of raving anti-Semitic lunatics. It's that those are the simple facts of the case, and the Americans are thoroughly lied to. Just like I was pleading guilty myself. It took me forever before I ever understood what the hell was the occupied territories over there. It was like a thing I hadn't learned yet for a long time. Like right now, for example, I don't know how to scuba dive. I mean, I know of scuba diving, and I bet it would be really fun to scuba dive. But I actually have never taken a class, and I don't know anything about it. And I wonder if I ever really tried to learn everything I need to know about scuba diving one day, like assuming I had a budget to spend on such a thing. Whether maybe I could learn all about that. But right now, it's a known unknown. It's something that I know is a thing, but that I know I don't know anything about. It used to be that way with Israel-Palestine. Oh, Israel-Palestine, I know it's a thing, and I don't really know about it, but I'm under the impression that everybody's wrong, and everybody is claiming a magical property right that I don't believe in, and so, meh. And I think that that's what most Americans think of it. If they're not just, you know, outright pro-Israel because that's what TV tells them to be or whatever. Or their preacher man tells them to be. I think most Americans' idea of what's going on there is something on the order of there's some state full of Arabs, some territory full of Arabs next door to Israel that just won't leave them alone. And that's why they had to build this big wall to keep them out and all this stuff. And they just don't understand that it's the Israelis who are occupying those people, who have them completely and entirely surrounded, and that it's been that way since 1967. But that's the reality of the thing. And of course, you know, Hamas and Hezbollah before them have done a terrible job, historically, and the PLO before them too, of making their case, because they do things like commit terrorist attacks against innocent civilians, which, when that takes place in front of a bunch of not even half-informed people, then it just seems like these guys are crazy aggressors who attack civilians, and that's all they are. And so, any sympathy they could have ever had goes right out the window. Nobody asks what would drive somebody to do such a thing. Obviously, evil would drive somebody to do such a thing, and so that's all we need to know. And so, never mind the fact that there are peaceful protests on the West Bank demanding liberty every day. Every day. That just don't get coverage. The only resistance you'll ever really hear of in American media would be if there was a real violent uprising again and suicide bombings went off. Then they'll say, you know what? The Israelis have had to retaliate against this suicide bomber who hit a checkpoint. And they'll just never tell you. They'll never even tell you that the West Bank is occupied territory. They'll just kind of imply that, well, anyway, whatever history is or whatever the situation is, some Arabs attacked some Jews and that's about all you need to know. It's just like George Carlin said. In fact, this is my first inkling of this when I was a kid. I was, 14 or something in 1992. When George Carlin was talking about language and how they lie to you and manipulate you, wasn't it the Jammin' in New York? It could have been Carlin on campus, so that would have been earlier. I think it was Jammin' in New York, where he said Israeli killers are called commandos. Palestinian or Arab commandos are called terrorists. And, you know, since even before that, I've been a George Carlinian with language. And I think probably it's because I was a very talented liar when I was like 7. But then I realized that there was blowback and eventually nobody believed anything I said anymore, you know? And so I kind of knocked it off. But it left me with this wonderful talent for seeing through other people's bullcrap. Since that's kind of my territory, you know? And George Carlin, of course, his history was his mother was the leading female advertising executive on all of Madison Avenue in the 40s and 50s and 60s. He was surrounded by people who did nothing but craft the science of deceiving people with words all day long. And in a setting where they believed they were acting wholly and completely legitimately. And so therefore, they acted with wild abandon. There was no restriction on just what level of dishonesty is too much dishonesty for getting something sold. And so Carlin grew up with that and, of course, then grew up completely immune to it and did a great job of teaching people like me that we're on the right track to try to contradict the manipulation of language by the Frank Luntzes of the world who try to pretend that the Palestinians are occupying the Israelis only because he knows. And his focus group, once they understand, they know that the truth is wrong.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This here is my show. And back to Iran for a minute here. Phil, friend of the show, longtime friend of the show, Phil C. sent this clip of Representative Duncan Hunter from Washington Journal, the C-SPAN morning call-in show this morning. Get a load of this.
Congressman, after the September 11th attacks in 2001, quit his job, joined the Marine Corps, and served in Iraq. How many times?
Twice in Iraq.
And where?
I served in Diwaniya, Hilla, which is where Babylon is, in 2003, and then Fallujah in the first Battle of Fallujah in 2004, and then Afghanistan in 2007.
Do you think war with Iran is inevitable?
I sure as hell hope not. Let's put it that way. I think a ground war in Iran with American boots on the ground would be a horrible thing. And I think people like to toss around the fact that we have to stop them in some way from gaining this nuclear capability. I don't think it's inevitable, but I think if you have to hit Iran, you don't put boots on the ground. You do it with tactical nuclear devices, and you set them back a decade or two or three. I think that's the way to do it, with a massive aerial bombardment campaign. But that's still a huge undertaking. It would cost billions and billions of dollars to do it. But no, I don't think, especially after. But that's still a huge undertaking. It would cost billions and billions of dollars to do it. But no, I don't think, especially after Iraq and Afghanistan. I think America now knows its limitations in that area and what we can do. And do we want to spend 20 years there after we tear it down to build it back up again so that it isn't run by crazy tyrannical leader like has happened in, let's say, Iraq and Afghanistan again. You got some crazy guys running the governments there. And unfortunately, what we've done to set that up has played a role in those countries not being great actors still.
The phones are lighting up. We'll get to our first phone call here in just a second.
God. But you know, I almost don't know where to begin with that. First of all, is that Duncan Hunter Jr. or something? I thought Duncan Hunter, didn't he run for president in 08 and he was an old man? Is this his nephew or something? What? I'm confused. Maybe I'm just confused. And then secondly, he sure is good on Iraq and Afghanistan, huh? Yeah, both of those wars have been disasters. All those battles he named? Fought for nothing, apparently, because put a bunch of terrible people in power in Iraq and Afghanistan, both, he says. Okay, good so far. And then the lesson from that is if we start an aggressive war against Iran, which would be perfectly fine, we should not attempt to go in there and, stay for 20 years and build a new government there and all of that. We've seen that that just doesn't work. So what we should do is just nuke them. You know, set them back with nukes. Huh. Isn't that something? You know what it is? It's like if you watch horror movies a lot, eventually it ain't really that scary anymore or something, you know? We're just everybody. It ain't just him. I am too. Everybody. We're all just so damn desensitized. Where what was the most dastardly damned thing in the whole wide world when the Japanese did it to us is now perfectly obvious fair play. And then the way that we ended the war with Japan, when they just would not give up, according to the lies, you know, is now how we would start one. Against a country who hypothetically would begin to try to get a single nuke of their own. Really. And then he wasn't even that strict in his definition about when the bombing starts either, was he? I mean, I didn't hear him say, listen, they're not making nukes now, but if they ever started, then we could try ABC before we nuke them. Something like that. All options are on the table. How many times can you say that before you really mean it? Nuclear first strike on a country that has no nukes. And you know what? Let me tell you a story about Barack Hussein Obama, all right? He came to power and gave a big speech about how he wants a nuclear weapons-free world someday long after his lifetime. This is a man in his 40s. Someday long after his lifetime, assuming that he doesn't get us all nuked soon, someday a world free of nuclear weapons, and as part of that, he announced a new American government policy. And this is a really big deal in the halls of power, apparently. What he said was, up until now, and this is true, up until now, America has reserved the right to use nuclear weapons in a first strike against any nation in the world that we feel like attacking, if we feel like it. But Barack Obama, in his benevolent, kind, patient wisdom, seeing far into the future, playing three-dimensional chess with the dangerous world we live in, announced that we now reserve the right only to use nuclear weapons in a first strike against other nuclear weapon states or Iran. There you go. Isn't that great? The USA is no longer threatening nuclear first strike against all nations on Earth. Not outright, anyway. Not that we won't nuke you, but just that's no longer our official stance like it was before. Now, the only countries where we would even think, policy-wise, of doing a nuclear first strike would be if that nation already has nuclear weapons. So, fair warning, Pakistan, I guess. But then they specifically exempted Iran from the statement. That was Barack Obama. We reserve the right to use nuclear weapons in a first strike. Google me, you don't like it. I'm telling ya. I kind of dropped the ya there, didn't I? I'm telling. I'm telling Barack Obama. I'm telling you. On him. I ain't doing radio good. But I am getting everything right. There you go. And then, what is he even talking about? How could anyone even hypothetically, like Duncan Hunter is saying here, how could anyone even hypothetically talk about using nukes on Iran? I mean, don't we have some big-ass daisy cutters? Whatever happened to that? Remember the Moab bomb, the mother of all bombs? Just happened to be named after the slaves of the ancient Israelites. Don't we have those? But no, the theory is that, hey, if the Natanz and Fordo facilities are under enough rock that that the U.S. Empire's deep earth penetrator bunker buster bombs can't quite get the job done, then you split some uranium atoms or split some plutonium atoms. Boy, wouldn't that be a turning point in the history of the world again? America uses nukes again in a first strike against a helpless piece of crap third world country. It has no aggressive designs on any of their neighbors or the neighbor two countries down, three countries down either. But, you know, this is a perfectly reasonable discussion among conservative Republicans and Democrats, you know, to some degree, I guess. I mean, in American political culture, that might be a little bit of an outlier position to say out loud that way, using the word nuclear like that. But isn't that what Rand Paul says? And isn't that what Barack Obama says? That all options must remain on the table to prevent Iran from ever obtaining a nuclear weapon? That's the empire you live in. Man. And by the way, if that happens to get you in an emotional way, they're like, hey, screw you, man, I'm from here. Let me just point out that it doesn't matter whether you're from here or not. It doesn't matter whether you believed in every lie they ever told you your whole life and supported every evil thing they've ever done their whole life up until just now. Doesn't make any of it right whatsoever. How could it possibly? What if you were born in Zimbabwe? Would that make Robert Mugabe the God's gift to your security? Or that'd just be your bad luck. Well, there's a lot of lucky things about being from America. But at least in my mind, I wouldn't really like put this on anyone else. But at least to me, I think that certainly those of us who can kind of have a responsibility to speak out about the horrible things that our government does to people around the world all day. Because it's some nightmare stuff, man. You know? There's a lot of stuff here in America to pay attention to, but there's a lot of real grief being perpetrated by the Republicans and Democrats in other people's countries that, you know, you hear tell about, but you never really get to see or smell or experience unless you're the one inflicting it. And then those guys, they don't like to talk to the rest of us anyway because we wouldn't understand, right? Because we weren't there like they were, so. Seems that way. All right, now, so, I guess if I had to put money on it, I would say we're staying in Afghanistan for as long as they can possibly do it, and that's going to be beyond next year. But then again, still got a whole year to go before the deadline. But Hamid Karzai, America's sock puppet dictator there, through two ridiculously fraudulent elections perpetrated by the United States. And it's true that actually in 2009, they tried to sabotage him and rig the election in favor of the other guy, but he just stole it better, but only because they put him in that position anyway. Abdullah is the name of the other guy. Remember that in 2009 when Obama was like, this Karzai's got to go. And then he was like, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. Please come to America and walk on my red carpet and kiss your ass and beg you to please kick the junk and get it together. But anyway, Karzai is playing hard to get on this thing and is saying, well, there's going to be elections in April and he'll let the next guy decide. Is he really not running for continued mayor of Kabul? I don't know. But he's been stalling and stalling and refusing to sign this agreement. They're not calling it a status of forces agreement. They're calling it something else this time. It's, I forgot what it's called this time. Same damn thing. It's a treaty, but they don't call it a treaty because then the Senate would have to have a say on it, and they want to make it just an executive agreement. But it's a treaty to keep America there. And just like with the Iraq War, the sticking point is immunity for American soldiers. Which is hilarious. That the Democrats are saying, look, our guys are going to be committing war crimes there for the indefinite future, and we want to make sure that they always get away with it. We can't have accountability for war crimes. Certainly not as determined by you locals representing, you know, the victims. Forget that. If you want America to stay and keep helping you, you better give us complete immunity for any war crimes we might commit. Are you kidding me? Man, I don't know. So, that's the position of the American government. Now, in Iraq, at that point, in 2008, Maliki didn't really need us anymore. Bush had finished winning the war for him. And he played George Bush, and we knew that on this show, we knew that because of Patrick Coburn more than anyone else, who said, nah, the Americans are losing influence fast around here, and, well, I'll paraphrase myself paraphrasing Patrick. He never said it this way, but basically the point was that Maliki was telling Bush, oh yeah, no, I want you to stay too, 56 bases, sure. And then he'd come back and go, well, you know, I was talking to the guys and they were saying, well, what about less bases than that? And then, well, geez, oh, yeah. You know what? Okay, how about 30 bases? Oh, I'll tell you what. You wait right here. I'm going to go talk to the guys and see if I, oh, no, I mean, I'm totally with you and everything. I just got to see if I can convince the guys to go along, you know. And then a couple of months later, he'd come back and go, you know, George Bush, they want fewer bases than that. What if we drag this out a little further? And then by November 2008, Bush had to go. Or maybe, I guess it was September because it was about to be the election. And so he had to sign something because the UN resolution authorizing the occupation was up. And so the immunity of the American soldiers was no longer protected under the bogus international law. And so they had to get the Iraqi government to ratify their immunity. And then, of course, the heroic Chelsea Manning leaked the war logs. This is in 2011 now. Oh, yeah, that's too late. See, I'm conflating my stories. Maliki put Bush off all throughout 08, and then Bush had to sign the sofa promising to get out by the end of 2011. Then Obama kept trying to say, well, let us stay. And you know, by the end of 08, by the end of 09, I guess they had to withdraw all their troops to their bases and basically stop doing anything and then except training, and then really leave by the end of 2011, which they did, which they had to do, because then Chelsea Manning had leaked the State Department cables and the Iraq and Afghan war logs, and in the Iraq war logs was proof of what the Iraqis had accused all along, which was that the Americans, some army soldiers, had committed a horrible war crime against this family and executed them all in their own home, including an infant, shot them at point-blank range, and maybe a couple of babies, actually. And then what happened was they called in an airstrike to try to cover it up. But the airstrike hit the wrong side of the house, so the corpses were intact, and the locals got a hold of them and did the autopsies and everything else. So the Iraqis knew exactly what happened all along, but the Americans lied about it. But then in the WikiLeaks, it came out that the Iraqis were right all along. This was a huge scandal in 2011, and that gave Maliki all the cover he needed, if he even needed it at that point, to tell Obama, I'm sorry, I just can't get you the immunity deal. You're going to have to leave. So that was how Maliki basically played the Americans and said, you know, I mean, really all he needs is the Iranians' help. He doesn't need us. He likes the Iranians and not us. So he can still get some money and weapons from us, but that doesn't mean us, mean the empire. But that doesn't mean he's loyal to the empire's goals whatsoever. Never really has been, except their goal of putting him in power to try to save face for their failure, that at least they pick the next guy, even if he's operating on behalf of the interests of himself and the nation next door instead of ours. But the Shiite Arabs are a majority in Iraq. And now that the Americans have helped them win their civil war and take the capital city, and the Sunni Arabs have virtually no chance whatsoever of taking it back, which was a fact by 08, they don't need us anymore. Maliki didn't need us anymore. But now the government in Kabul, I think, just might. In fact, the only thing that I know that would argue against that, that they would still need American support to keep them, to keep the Taliban from just walking right in, is that so many of the different factions of former so-called bad guys, on, you know, the people that the Americans have been fighting all along, have been brought into the coalition government at this point, that maybe it is a combination of enough horrible warlords to keep the Taliban warlords from taking Kabul at least very quickly. So, you know, I don't know exactly how far that's going to go. But then again, General Dostum and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and many of those other warlords who the Americans fought for a time have indeed been brought into the coalition. In fact, when I said to Ann Jones, well, you know, is it enough to keep the Taliban from walking right into Kabul and taking over the thing again? She says, you know, the Taliban are in the government now. They kind of already have walked right into Kabul and taken their places. So, you know, it's not just that you have the Americans paying the Taliban bribes to let their trucks go by to supply our guys out there in the field, and meanwhile, that's all the money that the Taliban needs to fight our guys, some protection money. But nah, we're actually fighting for a government that's partially Taliban as it is. What a disaster. And they want to stay. Why? Other than just they can't admit what losers they are. And maybe, you know, they want to keep the Chinese from walking in there with briefcases, and having a bunch of communists show a bunch of so-called capitalists how business is done. Yeah, what you do is you pay people money, and then they exchange their goods for the money. What the hell's the matter with you Americans, anyway? What do you think you are, Rome or something? Chinese send in a million-man army of men with briefcases full of money. Would you like to exchange your raw materials for the money that we have? There's a surge that'll work for you. Pretty much anyone will do business with anyone. It's a very important point. Where apparently it's not Bastiat who said this, but somebody once said that where goods do not cross borders, armies will. And in fact, Bastiat, whatever, however you say it, He did make that very point, just not in those exact words. But I don't know. Can you imagine having, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 years out from now, little kids who are just kids right now be having their guts blown out all over the place in Afghanistan still for nothing? I mean, come on, I know they let Bin Laden go for 10 years. But then they finally caught up with him and put bullets in his brain and made him dead. And so I think you can call off the war now. Your fake excuse for the war is dead now. Can we please go ahead and withdraw? And then, you know what? Withdraw by the end of 2014. And then in 2016, do a poll of Americans and ask them if they care at all what is happening in Afghanistan. Who's killing who? Yeah, didn't you know that the Chinese and the Iranians are fighting a giant proxy war? Really? Whose side is India on? I need to know for Trivial Pursuit purposes. Sure as hell don't care, would be the reply of all Americans to that situation. But then again, they're just as likely to sign up their son to go fight in the damn thing too. Ain't that something? That's what they mean by cognitive dissonance. People really use that phrase wrong all the time for just someone being uncomfortable when they're contradicted. But it really is, I think, it's much more of a double think, you know? Almost like, I imagine it anyway, like it's the hemispheres of your brain. Well, I know that America is a corrupt, evil empire, and that our government is the world's greatest purveyor of phony money and phony truths and horrible, aggressive violence. And I know that all of the wars that they fought for at least the last 20 years have been based on a bunch of lies and not even half-truths. And yet, the army is still legit. And signing my son up for it is still legit. And that'll make a man out of you, and you'll be all you can be. You can aim high. You'll learn the hard way what it means to have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and be a real man and take responsibility and move ahead in the world. And like I'm always complaining, like a lot of people are always complaining, if you watch their TV ads, the message is always, especially if you're black or brown, you've got no chance in this society unless you join the military first. And then the lesson for the parent, in fact, they even have ads deliberately targeted at minorities too, that are deliberately targeted at the parents. That when your kid comes to you and wants to join the military, it's disgraceful for you to try to intervene and stop that. This is their life, and it's time for them to grow up and take responsibility and be a real man or real woman and join the service. And somehow all those other things you know about how corrupt and dishonest and aggressive it all is just floats away. And you just sign him up anyway. And you tell your boy, well, son, if that's your decision, it's just like if he decided to work for this company instead of that company. After all, it's the government. It's the stamp of approval. That's why the private package business Federal Express named itself Federal Express and adopted a red, white, and blue logo, because they know that that's what you trust the most. Even though I know it's all wrong, I'm going to keep believing in it anyway, you say. That is cognitive dissonance. And it, to me, is incredible the way that they're able to continue recruiting. The way that at the airport, everybody is still supposed to pause and clap and call everybody a hero. When everybody already knows better. Right? It's like we started the show with the new Pew survey. The American people are against all these wars of aggression. Well, what's heroic about serving in a war of aggression? What's legitimate about signing up for that at all? They never answer that part. Because they can't.